This webcast is a service of SDPB. Good, useful, and full of wonder. SDPB.
You may be seated. Thank you. The third case set for argument this morning is Shadrach Howey and Alpha Land Company versus Gary and Gordon Howey. Appeals number 31191 and 31192. Kelly Peterson is arguing on behalf of the appellants, and John Stanton Dorsey is present arguing on behalf of appellees. Ms. Peterson, you may proceed with your argument. You want to come up to the podium? And then we'll start your 15 minutes when you get up here. Go ahead.
Okay. Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Kelly Peterson on behalf of appellants Shadrach Howey and Alpha Land Company. At its core, this case presents a straightforward summary judgment problem. The parties tell fundamentally different stories about what they agreed to, and there is evidence supporting Shad's account in the record. This court doesn't have to decide today whether Shadrach's version is ultimately true. The question is whether a reasonable fact finder could find that it is. And when the evidence is viewed in a light most favorable to Shad, the answer is yes. Parties dispute virtually every material aspect of the agreement that brought them into this development venture together, what they agreed to, how the property was to be acquired, owned, developed, how Alpha was supposed to be financed, what Shad was supposed to receive in return for his participation, and whether defendants ultimately performed their promises they made. And those disputes do not rest on Shad's testimony alone. They are reflected in the record in contemporaneous emails, the parties' written agreements, their subsequent conduct, and communications from the professional CPA in the case, James Postma, as well as communications with the lender. If reasonable minds can disagree about those material facts, this case should not have been decided on summary judgment. The breach of contract claim illustrates this problem particularly well. The defendants contend that the Alpha Land operating agreement constitutes the party's complete agreement, and it is the controlling contract in the case. But the operating agreement simply—
So just so we're clear, you're not, or Mr. Howey's not making any of these claims for breach of contract based on anything in the written portions of the contract. It's all separate oral contracts that he's asserting these breach of contract claims for?
He's asserting that when the parties initially met,
yeah,
they
but my question
discussed.
Is there anything in the written contracts that he's asserting provide him a basis for breach of contract?
Yes.
And what would that be? Which portions of the contract and which contract specifically?
If you're asking written terms in the contract, there are some in the Alpha Land purchase agreement relative to how the one-third share is supposed to be divided. And I think Postma explained that the way it's written in there is not how the parties intended. And that's in the brief. But also the fact that there are terms that are not included in that contract that are material to that contract.
No, I understand that. So, but that's part of his claim on this oral contract that he says was supposed to be put into writing and was not. But that's really based on, it's not based on what's in writing between the parties.
Yes, and then also there's the problems with the purchase agreement, the 1031 purchase agreement, which essentially all of the facts in that purchase agreement are not what the parties agreed to. They are just You know, they say that he's supposed to get the purchase price, that it's supposed to go to Shad, when in reality, the verbal agreement on the side, which you call side agreement, was that Shad would take that money and then he would actually give it to Alpha. He would incur a tax consequence. They agreed verbally that Alpha Land would pay that. He assumed the contract of deed personally as a result of that contract, but that contract, Mr. Postma explained, was deliberately written to omit the material facts because they didn't want to create a roadmap for the IRS because he was concerned about the step transition document.
So then let me step aside from whatever is in writing and the basis of any contract claims there. The unwritten portion of the oral agreements or representations that Mr. Howie's claiming were made to him, what specific promises or representations were made that that provide the basis for his claims, either for breach of contract or fraud?
Can I just grab my... It's Shad's claim that when the parties met and agreed to be in a partnership together to own and develop the real estate. You have to remember at this time he had other potential people he was going to invest with, and the decision to go with family rested upon what he claims to be the promises that were made to him, and there were many. Most important being equal partners in a partnership entity that would own and develop the partners or the property together, and they would share equally in the profits. That these interests would be held jointly with a right of survivorship, that he would have a lead role in site development and be paid for this, that he would be able, that the development would use non-corrosive rebar, that he would have the opportunity to build homes with company financing, and that all the members could benefit off the raw land, because there would be raw land for a period of time, so like farming and getting hay and all of those things, that everyone would equally share in that. He talks about what was talked about as walking money, basically that they were going to try and get early money through financing to get the partners some early money to help with different finances. He talked about the street names, which was really important to him because he wanted this to be a development in the name of God, so he wanted the street names in honor of God. And then they all agreed that that his brother Kelly would get a listing marketing development. So these are what Shad claims they were discussed, and this is what it was agreed to, and this is what induced him into entering into this partnership. The defendants, however, claim none of that's true, and that the only thing he was promised was a 1/3 net proceeds from development. Now, the problem is when
That would have been based on the capital contribution, right? Okay. So that's the part I don't quite understand. If I read correctly, the Alpha Land Agreement, they each get 1/3. They get to share 1/3 in the profit. But then it says, in relation to their or in proportion to the capital contribution. Can you explain that to me?
Yeah, and that's confusing, and that's why the operating agreement shouldn't be the controlling contract, because the I just forgot what I was going to say. Say it one more time, because I had a really good answer on my. That I was going to give you.
Well, if I'm reading it correctly, the Alpha Land Agreement equal shares, but profits based yeah. on capital contribution.
Gotcha. So Alpha Land was never, like, if you go back and you look at the evidence from the email from Postma in September 2019, which was 1 month before the closing where Shad was supposed to purchase the property, according to this whole plan. It's a very elaborate plan of how they're going to purchase it and all these things. Alpha Land was not even contemplated at that time. The original plan was that Gary was going to create an umbrella LLC to purchase the property from Shad, and then they would all come in as members of that LLC. That fits perfectly with what Shad claims was told to him, because in that situation, they all are 1/3 of a company that has just bought the real estate and is going to develop it.
So both, maybe this gets at, so am I right in thinking both the original operating agreement and the 2022 operating agreement list as capital contributions equal contributions. All three men are deemed to be equal partners, so their capital contributions would be equal among the three.
And I would argue at that time, Shad took all of the profits that he received when he sold the property and put that into Alpha. But that's not, those are all side verbal agreements, so that's not considered. It was just a basic LLC governing document. But you have to go back to the beginning because that was the agreement. If that had been the agreement, they would have all owned the property equally, which is a big difference to own.
Here's what I'm struggling with.
Yeah.
So those discussions, if you want to call them negotiations, discussions, whatever you want to call them, that happened up front, they ultimately signed agreements that your client signed off on. They're in writing. They explain what this transaction is. Doesn't that end it? I mean, how can he say, well, there were all these discussions up front, and now I want to bring those back in, even though that's not the written agreements I signed? How do you get around that?
Yeah, I think it's easy to get around it because the agreement changed, not because they agreed to different terms, because the CPA said, hey, listen, the agreement that you guys came up with, in which you're all going to own a portion of this entity that owns the land, that creates problems for Gary's tax liability through the 1031. It's my recommendation that you scrap that and we go a different route. He acknowledges that other CPAs may disagree with him, but he's kind of the one coming to him saying, I am recommending this other option.
But why does the reason matter if they all signed it?
I agree. The problem is when they made that diversion, the promises that were made was that this is not going to change the deal. It changed the mechanics, but not the deal. So the company is still going to own the property, Shad, but now it's going to be done in a different way. Either Gary's going to contribute the property, which is one option they looked at, or Alpha would buy the property. So they said, okay, we're gonna go a different direction, which required the terms of the agreement to change in order to keep the same underlying agreement in place, which Shad was okay with and everybody was okay with, but that changed it, and that's important because now you've got a contract that's changed on the base of the CPA. Everybody's already been performing the contract. It's in the mix. Now they change it, and the two big differences are Alpha Land's going to buy it now. Alpha Land has no capital. It is just a nothing entity. They form it. This is formed, you have to remember, in January. Shad purchased the property in October. So by this time, the deal's already underway. He's owned the property for 6 months.
I thought he signed it right away to Gary's Limited Partnerships.
So he signed a purchase agreement to buy the parcels, right? Shad did. Then he signed a purchase agreement with Gary's LPs to do the 1031 exchange. Part of that required him to pay a non-refundable down payment. That cash is what Shad used to buy the property from the property owners. But then Shad owned it in his name for 6 months. He did work on the property. He assumed the contract for deed. And then they formed Alpha way later.
So then I want to ask you about this. If it sounds like you're going under a theory of, well, we didn't have this in writing, but we were operating under this basis, part performance, if you want to call it that. Did you make that argument at summary judgment, or did you make that argument in this brief to the court?
I believe that's been the whole crux of what I've been arguing, is that there was never a formal agreement that said, this is how it's going to work. Gary's going to do this. They're going to do that. And again, I go back to it. They couldn't put that in writing because it shows the IRS that he's essentially, you know, there's going to be a big problem with it. So don't put it in writing. But they were going to, 1 month before the transaction in September, if they had gone through with the original plan that they had agreed to and done the umbrella LLC, then the property ownership wouldn't be an issue. So this comes up later down the road, and how do you handle it if you're Shad?
So
you're already stuck in the deal. How do you go forward?
So I guess I need to understand this. Are you saying that everything that they did was essentially colluding to cheat the IRS? That's why they couldn't put things in writing?
I would suggest looking at James Postum's affidavit because he was very uncomfortable with things that were occurring. He takes the position that he informed them that he, you know, this may or may not fly. It's totally up to the IRS, but he has serious concerns about these different risks.
So all these original agreements that you're talking about that Shad believes are the operative agreements, they weren't put in writing because that might show the IRS that they're trying to cheat on this 1031 exchange, correct?
I would say at the beginning, Shad's testimony...
I mean, it's simple. Correct or not correct?
Well, it depends on the time frame you're using. If you're saying...
Any time frame. Was there any time frame?
Yes.
All right. So why should we honor essentially what you are admitting to are illegal agreements?
I wouldn't... Are you saying they're illegal agreements?
Well, if they're intended to cheat the IRS. What I asked you.
I think POSMA... goes a very fine line. He doesn't come out and say that. He says, these are concerns that came up. I can't tell you how the IRS is going to look at this, but if you do it this way, you have a better chance of it not. It's not that it would be illegal. It's just that the 1031 exchange wouldn't work. It would fall apart. And that was important. So for everybody. So he's basically saying, I can't guarantee this, but I would recommend doing this. It's going to have less scrutiny if we do it this way. And if you're Shad, who doesn't have a lot of knowledge in 1031 exchanges, there was an attorney in the deal who backed out because it was overly, you know, above his pay grade when it came to 1031s.
So if most of your arguments relate to not the written agreements that were actually signed, but the side agreements and what the understanding was between the parties. Is your theory primarily a promissory estoppel? That was one of the claims.
He pled two things in the alternative, promissory estoppel and unjust enrichment, in the chance that we don't find that there was a formal contract made. However, I believe that these are just not, there's no integrated contract. It required multiple contracts. And my purchase agreements had to have an operating agreement because you're gonna organize the company. So these things were required. What's missing, one, is the separate contract that POSMA said. So I go back to POSMA saying, we're gonna go this new direction, but we're gonna add two things that are very important. One is that Alpha is going to need to capitalize using the property. He said, I very much understood that to be the deal of the parties, that Alpha Land was going to refinance the contract for deed. That in and of itself would have given Alpha Land 779 acres, which is almost half the property. It's very different to own a third of a company that owns property that's worth something than to own a third of a company that has no ownership rights, no development rights, and only has debt that it can't service. Because the purchase agreement for Alpha...
You got a red light. Unless somebody else has other questions.
Oh, sorry.
We need to wrap up. Anybody have other questions? Okay. Thank you, Ms. Peterson. Dorsey, you may proceed.
I'm John Dorsey. I represent Gary and Gordon, members of Alpha Land LLC. The question in this case is whether there's a disputed issue of material fact that Shad has been deprived of any legal rights existing under the original operating agreement, its amendment, and Chapter 4734A. It's the policy of that chapter and this state to give maximum effect to the freedom of contract and the enforceability of operating agreements. Among the affirmative defenses that we pled were the business judgment rule and the absence of any special injury to Shad as a member. I intend to devote my argument first to the application of sections 103B, 409, 1101B in the context of member majority amendments and the consent necessary, and the duty of good faith and fair dealing. Second, to our counterclaim for expulsion by judicial determination, which referenced In our counterclaim, his conduct as being one in breach of the duty of due care under 409 and the operating agreement. And in the final analysis, the court disassociated Shad under 6016 subsection little 3. The existence and scope of the party's duties in this member-managed LLC are questions of law. 113 directs that the law of this state governs the internal affairs of an LLC. Rome was not built in a day. And the development for 3,000 lots for homes on 1,333 acres of raw land in Box Elder would take decades. A partnership was not what resulted here. A partnership dies with the death of a partner. An LLC provides continuity of life. And the organizers were family members of the Howie clan. The vehicle chosen for the development was a member-managed LLC. Organizers, Gary and Gordon, were in their 70s, Shad, I think about 39, and Kelly in his 50s. None of the organizing members of the Howie family were strangers to risk. Their eyes were wide open, and they worked with professionals. A written operating agreement was signed by all the members, and each is deemed to assent to the operating agreement as a matter of law. That's section 103. Amendment was permitted by a majority. Consent under 404.1C defaults to section 103. Consent is unanimous unless 103 does not apply.
And they had an agreement here that a majority could modify.
Well, that was the beginning. The first agreement said a majority can't. But still, the LLC Act would control as to whether or not the provisions of the LLC are in violation of 103C. Nobody had a crystal ball for how circumstances would change, but they did change. And in a continuing business like an LLC, things changed. What never changed was an equal vote regarding management, the operations, and right to equal distributions. What Shad could not abide was majority rule. Circumstances changed, and dissension resulted. And we spent a lot of time in our briefing and our statement of material facts with the court as to that history.
It sounds like, in some ways, what you really couldn't abide is the failure of Alpha to become vested and acquire the 1,300 acres. He really had that view, and I guess when that didn't happen, because, I mean, I understand your argument. I mean, he's still a one-third owner, as we sit here today, presumably. Yeah.
He's a one-third owner in net profits. The only way they could set this thing up was for Gary to come in with a 1031 exchange. Gary's LPs owns the land. Be there no mistake.
No, I understand that. But I thought that, but it seems like the argument is that as it was originally conceived, and even through the iterations from the CPA, there was going to be a different outcome, at least as envisioned by Shad.
Yeah.
Otherwise not written down, and I think by admission of his lawyer, this is an oral agreement, but
right.
This is what he envisioned.
These changes made with regard to the amendments, and there's no two amendments. It's the original operating agreement and the amended and restated operating agreement for continuation. It was made on the advice of legal counsel. It was legal under the Act and reasonable under all the circumstances at the times these changes were made. An operating agreement is not just a creature of contract, which Judge Lang talks about in Expansion Capital, but it's a statutory form of contract. And Getzinger coins the term organizer sovereignty, explaining the extreme judicial ability to set aside terms in an operating agreement. The Act provides the freedom of organizers to determine the terms of the contract, limited only by the statutory limitations and prohibitions in Section 103. The amendment, if an amendment, would contravene 103B, it would require majority consent. Again, under 404.1C, which defaults to 103, and the court has to decide, in the first instance, the scope, of whether or not this applies.
No, I understand all those. We have our recent Trigger Energy case where we talked about the Act and about limited liability companies and governance and that sort of thing. The question is, do any of those rules really get at or respond to, and I understand this is how you want to focus your argument, but how do those arguments allow us to resolve the arguments about, hey, look, there are extra textual arguments, or excuse me, promises that are alleged here. The operating agreements, such as they are, the allegation is don't contain, you know, they may govern how the LLC is to be run and operated, but they don't contemplate, by their terms, the promise or promises that Shad alleges.
Well,
so it seems like there's kind of missing each other, the arguments.
Well, they are missing each other, I suspect, because the vehicle which was chosen was the LLC. The vehicle that was chosen was one where over the next decades things are going to change. And Gary and Gordon, and in setting this up, was under the advice of Postma. That advice, by the way, that they were going to do something different with these different opportunities, that might have been in September. But by January 6th, in Postma's email to all of the members, he said, we're going to do it this way. And as a matter of fact, he is looking in his email at the purchase agreement with the addendum.
Is the argument then that Shad assented to that along the way, and as part of this evolving process, that he left some of these, contrary to what he says now, he left some of these oral agreements in the back and moved forward?
It was ratification, and we argued that before the circuit court, and I can speak to some of the changes if the court would like, for example, that were made on succession. There was nothing wrong with changing the rule on succession. The rule on succession only applies to a person other than a member in 103D. Shad was a member. He wasn't a person other than a member, manager, or transferee. You can look up the definition of member, and you can look up the definition of transferee. The LLC had the ability to change this. These changes were coordinated with Tellinghuisen and Kurt Jensen, and if the court will look to the communications with the attorneys in this record, it will see at settled record 1908 through 1911, 1925 through 1928, the machinations that were going on. Shad had come to them saying, this is illegal. You can't do this. So what did Gordon do? He sent Section 409 and the definitions to Kurt Jensen and Tellinghuisen, and they look at it and they say, no, you're good to go. Those amendments that you have adopted in May of 2022 are fine. You're good to go.
So can we go, I want to ask you about your counterclaims. You've got this money loaned. One of the loans was made by one of the Howey brothers to Shad, that $150,000. And then there was another $30,000 loan later. That was made by Alpha Land, but Alpha Land isn't on the counterclaim. It's your two individual partners. The other question I have, I'm just wondering if the parties are aligned right. So and then we've got this disassociation by judicial determination, which is your counterclaim. Yeah. Doesn't Alpha need to be a party on that? And you know, I know they're a plaintiff, and I don't know who's representing Alpha. I don't know how Alpha became a plaintiff. I don't know if it has any claims. I'm just trying to figure out if the parties are aligned right.
Well, I think Alpha Land became a party because Shad made it a party.
Right. No, I know that.
And suggesting that this was a direct action and then a derivative action. This is a direct action, and 1101B speaks to
this
that.
This is a direct action by Shad personally.
Against members.
Right.
Right.
But then we've got, but then we, you've got, and so I'm asking about your counterclaims, which appear to involve Alpha, but Alpha doesn't appear to be a party on those counterclaims.
That's true.
Both as to the loan and as to the judicial determination. So do we, is there an issue there?
Well, no, there's not an issue. There's not an issue because this, all of the parties to the issue are all present in this case. All right? And more than, this is where the court should make these determinations, and did in fact make these determinations based upon quite a tortured history involving this family that no longer got along. I think we had an issue here where we had a situation where confirmation bias on the behalf of Shad, when he was told that this was illegal and wrong when it really wasn't, became a man who hears what he wants to hear and disregards the rest, as Paul Simon said.
So if we were to find that there was not a disputed facts as to a breach of contract here, does a promissory estoppel theory, can that still exist with the way this went down? Well, and I'd like to hear
It could have Shad put any money into the purchase of the land, but Gary bought the land, and the LLC statutes say that a member is not entitled to any remuneration, all right? And the Bunta case, which I cite, also reflects the LLC rule that says the services performed and to be performed for an LLC are not compensable, okay? So those statutes, you know, when you take this case apart and you see a lot of the briefing on the oral contract issues, statutes of fraud, promissory estoppel, negligent entrustment, all of these things, if you circle back and start with the fiduciary duties as we did before the court, there wasn't a fiduciary duty before, and there wasn't a fiduciary duty after the operating agreement was amended, okay? And
well, the statutes do, though, require, as between members, a duty of loyalty and a duty of, right, by statute.
Those, the only two fiduciary duties we didn't mess with. In Section 12, we didn't change any of those duties. The good faith and fair dealing duty, which is inherent in all contracts since Garrett v. BankWest, okay, not a tort, a contract. You can't find more facts with members of a company who were more patient and trying to cooperate with Shad, giving him every opportunity, advancing him lots for development. Gary grants him a $150,000 loan.
That's where your business judgment rule comes into place there.
Yes.
And you think there's no fact dispute?
I think that's for the court. And when you do that balancing that's required under the business judgment rule, it tips the scale. We don't get to a jury case on that. The court needs to enforce the operating agreement and give maximum effect to freedom of contract in South Dakota. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dorsey. Ms. Peterson, you may proceed with your rebuttal for 5 minutes.
To go through this really fast because I have a lot to cover. As of January 10th, 2020, this was after Shad purchased the property and when Alpha Land was being formed, Shad owned this property. So you have to ask the question, was he allowed to just keep the property and say, I don't want to go through with it anymore. Here's your money back, Gary. I'm just going to keep the property. He had already gotten the contract for deed, which was half of it. He had an investor willing to chip in on the other. But they say, no, that wasn't the deal. The deal was, you're going to take the money. You're going to put it in escrow. You're going to use it to develop the property, and then you're going to sell it to Gary. And all those proceeds are going to go to Alpha Land. So by just those terms alone, this isn't an integrated, there's no integrated contract when you've got all these verbal site agreements that they're the actual terms. So I struggle with how we find an integrated contract that addresses all of these things. The operating agreement simply says that they're equal partners of a company that was created way after the fact. And again, I want to stress the importance of these two things that POSMA is very clear about when they change direction. There has to be a separate legal contract, which is the development rights. Because without the right to develop, Alpha, what is Alpha? Without the right to purchase the property and do the refinance and get the funding, what is Alpha? That's where this change became so important and these terms became so important. Because what did happen? The purchase agreement to Alpha says, Alpha, you have to pay everything. You have to pay the contract for deed payments, the property, all of these things. Alpha has no money. So if they don't get a refi, if they don't get financing, Alpha defaults. And that's what Alpha did. They declared, the defendants declared in default. Gary sends Shad's attorney an email saying, we'll just call this in default. And the purchase agreement's gone, and Alpha gets nothing, and Shad gets nothing. That's exactly what has occurred, and that's exactly what they've said is going to happen. Gary reached out to an attorney and said the same thing.
Did Alpha sell the... Did I understand that correctly? Alpha ended up selling everything for just over $8 million to Unimax, correct?
Alpha sold some property. It's over, like, a course of time. Like, they have... They had to buy the first phase, and then they have...
How does Unimax fit into this?
Unimax is a company owned by... One of the owners is Kelly Howie, which is Shad's brother. And they came in and offered to buy some of the property.
From whom?
From Alpha Land. Even though Alpha Land doesn't have title, it goes through some weird thing where Alpha Land is like the middleman, and it's confusing. You have to look in the brief. But I just really want to hammer down on the fact that by not getting this refinance, which Post was very clear was supposed to happen, and you can look at the Banner Capital emails. This was happening. This was what was going to happen. And it only stopped when Gary stopped it, and it deprived the company of land. It deprived them of rights to finance. All of these happened, which has essentially left him with nothing. They say that he has one-third of net proceeds. He doesn't. If Alpha Land doesn't have the developmental rights, Alpha Land folds up, he gets nothing. But he compensated for all of the work that he did for the years. He's received nothing. He's had the ability to build two homes. So I would say he hasn't had any consideration. And if there's anything else. And also, just please look at my brief because I go into the minority oppression, which has to do with the right of survivorship. And I think that there's a factual dispute as to whether or not that was a central thing that decided, a deciding factor, which Shad testifies, and there's other corroborating testimony that said that was central to him joining the business. So this isn't an amendment that is just to a minor thing. This was an amendment to a core thing, ownership, how it's owned. This isn't a business judgment. This isn't it's just, you know, we didn't make the money we thought we were going to make. This was a core term. So I would encourage the court to read that. And also really important is the unjust enrichment claims, which were for the services. If you look through that, Shad performed a lot of services on the property, from fencing, rodent control. There's a whole bunch in there. Wasn't compensated for all of that. There's a factual dispute as to whether or not it was gratuitous, but those are all facts. Those are all should be in front of a jury. Just should the fraud claims should be in front of the jury. They have specifically said that the entity was never supposed to own the property. That's contradicted by Postma's emails. That Alpha was never supposed to finance. That's contradicted by all of the evidence. So I think that there's a ton of factual disputes in this case. It should never have been a summary judgment case. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this morning. We'll be in recess.